Hello, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio's Find Yourself, Live Your Dreams, and Be Happy show. I'm your host, Yvonne Brown, coming to you live from Chicago, Illinois, as I usually do every second Saturday of the month at 2 p.m. Central Time. Find Yourself, Live Your Dreams, and Be Happy is an interactive internet talk radio show that focuses on how to take advantage of the opportunities that life sends your way. The program explores obstacles overcome by ordinary people with extraordinary results and what inspires or motivates them to take positive actions that make their dreams a reality. I know a little about that myself, as I've had 10 careers. My first career after arriving in the United States from Jamaica was as a fashion model. Then I was a singer on the MCA label, corporate consultant for Accenture, and today I'm a professional speaker and trainer, author, blogger, certified professional coach, leadership and confidence coach for Forbes Coaches Council, certified John Maxwell coach, and radio show host. Let's set the tone for today's show. Potter Stewart said, "Ethics is knowing the difference between what you have a right to do and what is right to do. Ethics and equity and the principles of justice do not change with the calendar. A man without ethics is a wild beast loosed upon this world. Live one day at a time, emphasizing ethics rather than rules." We have a fantastic show for you today. Joining us later will be Jonathan Goldson. Our topic today is titled "The Answer to Everything and the Secret of Ethical Affluence." Why do we keep trying to reinvent the wheel? Why do we endlessly pursue happiness but never catch it? Why do we think we have to choose between success and integrity? The wisdom of the ages lies open before us. Yet, we keep looking for modern-day prophets to tell us what the ancients have already revealed. However, if we learn to apply the teachings of King Solomon and the sages that followed in his footsteps, we can find insights that will dazzle us with their contemporary brilliance and guide us along the path of personal and professional prosperity. Success in any endeavor is a mindset that develops organically once we recognize that good ethics is good business. Our speaker today is Jonathan Goldson. Let me tell you a little bit about him. After graduating from the University of California, Jonathan Goldson embarked on an adventure hitchhiking across the United States and backpacking across Europe. He ended up in Israel, where he spent 9 years studying the ancient wisdom of the land and receiving his rabbinic ordination. He went on to teach high school for the next 23 years in Budapest, Hungary, Atlanta, Georgia, and St. Louis, Missouri, where he and his wife live happily as empty nesters. As director of Ethical Imperatives, LLC, Rabbi Goldson now gives keynotes and trainings to teach professionals how good ethics is good business. He's a TEDx speaker and author of 5 books, including Proverbial Beauty, Secrets for Success and Happiness from the Wisdom of the Ages, and also Fix Your Broken Windows, a 12-step system for promoting ethical affluence. Now, I am also very interested in ethics and was fascinated by the mindset that Jonathan Goldson brought. So I brought him as our guest this month, and I'm really looking forward to hearing more from him. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me on, Ron. Pleasure to be with you.
You took a rather unusual path to get where you are now. Is there one lesson in particular that stands out from your early experiences?
Well, yeah, absolutely. When you graduate from the University of California with a degree in English, you have to ask yourself, what am I going to do with this English degree? You could do what I do, which was to go hitchhiking across the United States. Now, when you hear the word hitchhiker, you often think this is somebody who wants something for nothing. But that's not really the case. If you hear a hitchhiker and you climb into the cab of a car, you should see the driver as your benefactor. You should feel indebted to him. And the way you pay off that debt is by being of service. And what many drivers want from a hitchhiker is someone to listen. Right? You're familiar with the strangers on a train principle? When you get into the cab of a car, a driver and a hitchhiker have no expectation they're ever going to see each other again. That's the safest environment in the world for self-disclosure. And on more than one occasion, I had drivers tell me that the stories they were sharing with me, they had never told their wives or their children, their parents, or their best friends. And what I realized is that they weren't really talking to me. They were talking to themselves. They just needed to be there so they could feel comfortable doing it. Because I wasn't framing in my mind how I was going to respond, what I was going to say in return, I listened much more carefully. And I learned much more about them. And in the process, I learned more about myself. And what I came to understand from those experiences is that so often we don't listen to each other. And when we don't listen to each other, we don't get to know each other. And that leads to a breakdown in our relationships, whether it's in our families, in our businesses, in our communities. You look at the kind of what passes for dialogue and debate on talk radio and news, that people are shouting each other, they're insulting each other, they're ridiculing each other, and they may not even be able to articulate what the other person's saying. If I can't explain why you believe what you believe, how can I be sure you're wrong? If I can't understand why you're arguing with me, how can I be sure I'm right? There has to be a certain amount of willingness to hear the other side, to understand another point of view, to recognize the possibility there could be more than one legitimate point of view. And when we cultivate a community culture where there's that free exchange of ideas, we combat that corrosive influence of groupthink, which is the retreating into our little enclaves of ideology and vilifying anybody who doesn't think like us. This is really the key to being successful in every aspect of our lives.
That is very, very true. How did becoming a rabbi, though, prepare you for engaging the professional world?
Well, if you walk into a study hall, a Jewish study hall, you would be astonished at what you see. You walk into a public library, right? It's quiet. You can hear a pin drop. You walk into a study hall and people are shouting at each other and yelling at each other, and they look like they're ready to go for the throat. In fact, Jewish history says that the great Torah academies of 2,000 years ago, when they argued, it was as if they fought with swords and spears. It was so passionate, so fervent. But as soon as they left the study hall, they were friends. They got on great. They married the sons and daughters to each other. It never got personal. Their passion was for the truth. And as heated as the debates became, they always were sure to make certain they understood the other side.
Mm.
You can't argue with somebody if you don't know what they're talking about.
And good point.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds so simple and logical, but you see that it's not the way the world works. So the intellectual integrity of knowing another position, and then you're able to argue from a point of view of logic rather than emotion, that ability to separate out emotion from logic is really the key to having civil debate, to be able to articulate complex ideas and to recognize that there may be a higher truth than the truth that I'm comfortable with, than the perception of the way that I see things. And when you look at these 12-step programs, they all begin with recognize there's something greater than yourself. Because if I think I'm the center of the universe, then I'm always going to be frustrated that the universe is not accommodating me. If I recognize that there's a bigger plan and there's a bigger concept, then I start to think, well, how am I responsible for fitting myself into the context of the larger world?
Absolutely. That's very good. Now, you say that the answers to modern problems can be found in ancient teachings. Can you give us some examples?
Oh, sure. There are countless examples. One of my favorite sources is King Solomon's Book of Proverbs. King Solomon, we're told, is the wisest man who ever lived. And the challenge of the Book of Proverbs is that the writings of 3,000 years ago don't always immediately lend themselves to 21st century thinking. So we have to look for ways to adapt his lesson and apply them to our own times and find how the wisdom is relevant to us. So famous verse, he says, "Go sluggard and learn from the ant." Well, the simple meaning is, look at an ant. An ant is always working. Always. They never stop. And the ants don't decide for themselves what they want to do. They're following however they're wired, they're doing the bidding of the queen. And so there was a study done a few years ago, really fascinating, they observed ants traveling. And they noticed that when the traffic gets thicker among the ants, they actually start moving faster. You think about what happens on our roads during rush hour, right? You have gridlock, you have congestion, you have honking and accidents. The ants go faster and they get there more safely. So they started trying to understand why is this so, and they came up with three different insights into why ants are more efficient traveling than human beings. First of all, ants have no egos, right? An ant doesn't care if another ant gets in front of it. So instead of trying to jockey for position and cut people off and make sure that guy doesn't get in front of me, if we would just be a little more chill about it all, back off a little bit, slow down. Slowing down actually speeds up the flow of traffic because there isn't that constant stopping and starting. Again, it's easier to read what other people are going to do.
That's true.
Another observation is that ants don't mind if they bump into other ants. You know, so this may not be practical on our highways, but if you think about how easily people are offended, right? Somebody brushes up against me and they go, oh, who's this guy? What is he thinking? Why is he invading my space? Right? The ants don't get worked up about those things. We all go in the same direction. We all want to get to the same place. Okay, this little jostling, no harm, no foul. And the third thing they know is that ants respond to pressure with greater focus. Right? When we feel pressure, our minds start to go everywhere. We start to worry, am I going to get there at time? What's the fastest way? Should I be going a different way? What's going to be down the road? Maybe I should have left earlier. And because we get distracted, we're less efficient, and we actually can make things more dangerous. But when the ants are under pressure, they become hyper-focused and much more conscious of where they are, where they're going, what they're doing, and they get there faster and safer.
Okay, I get you, but I'm going to play devil's advocate here because as I was listening, I could hear lots of people going, I'm not an ant, and I'm not relating to this ant analogy at all. So I understand your perspective of working together as a team, getting stuff done for a purpose, and spreading things out so that you actually have a better flow of traffic in those examples and so on. But to me, that's not like fitting with me as a human being. Lots of people will say, I can't get this ant thing. I have them in my seminars all the time. So can you give us a more practical example, like from a business perspective, for example?
Okay, sure. King Solomon says, let your eyes look directly forward, and your eyelids will straighten your path. Okay, on the surface, it sounds like, all right, watch where you're going. Which doesn't sound like it's that deep and that profound. But in 2009, there was a fascinating study done. They blindfolded people, and they asked them to walk a straight line. What happened? 100% of the time, people ended up walking in circles. And sometimes they went in big circles, sometimes they went in small circles, sometimes they went to the right, sometimes they went to the left. They couldn't discern any pattern. It didn't matter whether you're right-handed or left-handed or the size of your shoes. Nothing seemed to indicate a pattern, except that everybody ended up coming back to the starting point. And they wasn't just walking. They had people swim, and they found they did the same thing. This is kind of scary. They put people behind cars. Not sure how they did that safely, but people drove in circles. And there's something hardwired in us, apparently, that makes us go round and round, always seeking our starting point again. Well, what's the answer? The answer is pretty simple, is keep your eyes focused on a point in the distance. As long as we have something in the distance where we can fix our attention and we can use that as our point of reference, then we can protect ourselves from going in circles. So in a business sense, if we're too tightly focused on the next step and the next job and the short-term goals and the short-term gains, we may find ourselves going round and round in circles. But if we can project into the future, if we have a long-term goal and a vision of where we want to be, then we have much, much greater probability that we're actually going to end up where we're supposed to be. Or you know what Yogi Berra said, if you don't know where you're going, you're going to end up somewhere else.
Most likely. You can end up almost anywhere if you don't know where you're going. What do you mean when you use the term ethical affluence? How's this? I'd like the answer to both of these things. What do you mean when you use that term, ethical affluence, and how is that the answer to everything?
Well, if you look at the statistics, and these are old statistics, it's probably worse now, but $550 billion are estimated lost in American companies every year through employee disengagement. $359 billion from employee conflict. When people are not focused on their jobs, they find all kinds of things to get upset about, to clash, to braid up against one another, to be inefficient and ineffective. And the price tag on that was a fortune. Right? Moreover, companies that are rated highest for ethics, they tend to gain value faster than companies that aren't. So how do you create a culture of engagement and one in which you minimize conflict? It's by creating a culture of ethics. They did a study recently, last year, and they asked employees, what is the number one criterion that you look for from a job? What do you want most from your job? And the number one answer was a boss we can trust. Think about that.
Yeah.
Right? They could have said pay. They could have said promotion. They could have said who knows what. Right? But time off. But they want to feel that their boss trusts them and they can trust their boss.
Yeah.
Because that's how you turn a place of business into a business community. And once everyone involved feels that they're a member of the team, they feel appreciated, they feel this fairness in the culture, they work more efficiently, they enjoy their jobs more, they get more out of what they're doing, they feel fulfilled, become whole, happier people, and get on better with their family so that they feel energized and happy when they come back to work. You create a culture of ethics, and you create a culture of affluence. You know, people become happier, they become more successful, everybody's making more money. It's a win-win all the way around. So when I say it's the answer to everything, if we start looking for what can I do as an individual, all the more so if I'm a boss, but even if I'm an employee, what can I do to hold myself accountable to a higher standard of integrity, to hold myself accountable to be more aware of my ethical responsibilities to the people that I'm involved with in work, and in play, and in community, and my family, then that is going to ripple outwards. Everybody, you know, it's a lot nicer to work with nice people.
You think?
A lot. Yeah. You want the wisdom of the ancients. Here it is. Be nice. Treat people. You know, we say treat people the way you want to be treated. It's really more nuanced than that. Treat people the way they want to be treated.
I'm on board with that. Yeah.
And once you do, then people are more likely to treat you the way you want to be treated. And bosses trust employees, and employees trust bosses, coworkers trust coworkers, and business flourishes.
And the customer might trust you too.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you walk into a store and you see everybody's happy. Right? You sit down in a business meeting and you see that this is a team where everybody gets along with each other and they show respect to each other, right? And you go, wow, guys, these people really walk the walk. I want to work with these people. I want to do business with this place.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah. So we're talking about ethical affluence and we're talking about ethics. And I am a huge proponent of ethics. So I'm wondering, do you think that we're facing a crisis in ethics today? And if so, what can we do about it?
Well, if you read the headlines, it's hard not to come to that conclusion. The scandals in certainly politics, but in business, what was this recent thing with Volkswagen? They were intentionally manipulating the results on, I think they were very, very exhaustive in the details, but I mean, it's not just individual behavior. You have whole company cultures of corruption.
Yes.
And we're outraged about it. We read about it. We shake our heads. And then the next day, there's another headline. So it certainly looks like we're in crisis. On the bright side, there's a growing awareness that we better do something about it. So what we can hope is that the backlash to ethical scandals will create a new ethical movement. But some of the immediate strategies, one of the lines I like to use is that compliance is often the enemy of ethics. And why do I say that? Because what are compliance rules? They're an attempt to legislate ethical behavior. And that's an oxymoron. It just doesn't work. Because for every law, for every regulation you create, you simultaneously create at least one loophole that people can get through it and around it.
Yeah.
How do you create ethics? Ethics is a mindset. It's a way of looking at the world. It's a commitment to do the right thing. It's a desire to recognize what is the right thing so I can do it. Ethics is what governs the gray areas in our lives. Those things that aren't strictly legal or illegal, when I develop in myself a desire to do what's right because it's what's right, because I recognize that ultimately it's in my best interest and everybody else's best interest, and we all win when we do the right thing.
That sounds really nice and wonderful, but, you know, I know someone who has said, oh, all this stuff about ethics is good and fine, but from where I sit, the people who are unethical are the ones who are succeeding and getting ahead. So why should I bother? It doesn't pay me to do that.
Well, that really may be true in the short term. In the short term, you can win by cutting corners, by blurring lines, by fudging your results. But in the long term, ask Bernie Madoff how well that works out.
Well, he lived very well for a very long time. I'm playing devil's advocate, right? I'm being that bad person.
Well, that's true. But there's always an accounting. The chickens come home to roost sooner or later.
Yeah.
And certainly for an individual, we can make that. We can say, listen, I'm willing to take the risk. I'm willing to take the risk that I'll get away with it long enough to make it pay off. So there has to be, on some level, there has to be a recognition that this is not the way human beings are supposed to be.
Yeah.
And when you look at somebody like Bill Gates, who has certainly more money than many people could spend in many lifetimes, and he now devotes himself to doing good in the world. There are a lot of very wealthy philanthropists who want to make a difference. They want to make the world a better place. They want to take their success and now share it with others. It's a mindset. It's an attitude. It's a recognition. In biblical Hebrew, the word for charity comes from the root meaning justice. It doesn't come from the root meaning kindness or compassion or mercy. Because if I have more than I need, it's only just that I look for ways to help people who don't have what they need. This is what makes a community thrive, flourish. And it's so much better to live in a community like that. Instead of always having to look over my shoulder and wonder, am I going to get caught? Am I going to get in trouble? Is somebody a kid? Is somebody going to outmaneuver me? It doesn't mean we shouldn't have business. It doesn't mean we shouldn't have a capitalist free market structure. It doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with being successful and getting wealthy through success. But not in a way that we lose our sense that we are in a community of other people and that we have a responsibility to others to the degree that we have the resources to help them.
Good point. Now, I know that you have a little acronym about ethics, and because we talked about it while we were chatting, and I would love for you to share that with the audience here.
Absolutely. So, if you have a pencil and paper or your keyboard, right, the E in ethics is for empathy. And that's what we were just talking about. What is empathy? Empathy is the ability and the willingness to try. try to feel what somebody else is feeling. If you think about what makes a good friendship, what makes a good marriage, what makes a good relationship between parents and children, right, is trying to put myself in the other person's shoes. Right? How am I going to make my wife happy? Instead of thinking about what's she going to do for me, right? What can I do for her? Right? That mindset of empathy to anticipate how other people are going to be affected by my behavior. And when I throw a stone in a pond, the ripples go all the way to the edges. And anticipating how my actions are going to influence and affect others is the first step of being ethical. It's that empathy to anticipate others' feelings. The second, T is trust. And that's almost a natural outcome. Right? A person, who are the people you trust? The people that you know are conscious and conscientious of how their actions are affecting you. I mean, sometimes it's so simple. Two people come to a doorway at the same time. You ever see two people in the door?
Yeah.
And one saying, after you. No, after you. No, after you. No, after you. Doesn't happen that often.
I've seen it happen. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little silly. It's a little funny, but it's nice. It's nice to see that people can be more concerned with others and deferring to others in a way that it doesn't cost anything to themselves. When we show that other people are a priority in our minds, that's how people come to trust us. And once people trust us, then we know we can trust them.
That's true. Okay.
And it's a great, it's a great feeling to be able to trust people. Know people have your back.
Yeah.
Have other people's back. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful thing. And so after that, the H is honesty. And honesty doesn't just mean being honest with other people. That we should take for granted. But being honest with ourselves. The writer Robert Heinlein said once that self-deception is the root of all evil. When we convince ourselves of whatever is convenient, whatever is expedient, whatever we feel like doing, I feel like doing it, I'm going to now find the justification to do it. That's living in a self-deceiving world. And to be able to look at, you asked earlier about, why shouldn't I be unethical and make a profit? That's not the person I want to be. That's not my self-image. That's not what I'm in this world to do. That's not something that ultimately is going to bring prosperity and success to the world or to me, ultimately. So to have that sense of honesty and being willing, again, going back to what we talked about earlier, to listen to other people, to hear other ideas, to evaluate ideas that may seem strange or may seem to contradict my ideas, give them a fair hearing before I shoot them down. That's all part of honesty. That's what makes communication possible.
Mm-hmm.
The I is improvement. Whatever I've accomplished in my life, however expert I may be in a particular area, there's always room for improvement. I can always do better. Right? You think about some of the great athletes who, even after they were at the top of their careers, the height of their careers, and they would still go out and practice and practice and practice. Because if I'm not going up, I'm going down. If I'm not getting better, I'm getting lazy. And
that's true.
And people in business, you made $1 billion. Yeah, but this is what I do. this is what I do. If I don't keep at it, something else is going to come along and take me down. So just for that sense of self-respect and self-worth, that I can always do better and I always want to do the best I can. That's the mindset of improvement. The C is something I think is desperately needed today, and that's civility.
Yeah.
I read once that civility, I think Stephen Carter points this out, civility is the root of civilization.
Ah, I like that.
Yeah, listen, you're living in a world, and again, it goes back to your question about why should I be ethical, because I'm living in a world with other people. King Solomon said, one who digs a pit will fall into it, and one who sets a stone rolling will have it roll back on him. He's not just talking about karma. saying, if I'm not watching out for other people, then other people are going to stop watching out for me. If I dig a pit and I don't care if you fall in it, then you're going to say, look, nobody's looking out for me. I'm going to dig my pit. And more people dig pits, more people get hurt. And eventually, I'm going to fall in the pit. That's my fault because I started it. That's my pit.
Yeah.
Wouldn't be there if not for me.
Yeah.
Right? So the idea of being civil, yeah, it's in the way we speak, it's in the way we act, it's in the way we conduct ourselves. So when we walk down the street, you know, we can do this in St. Louis because it's a fairly small town. It's harder than Manhattan. But when I walk down the street, I try to make eye contact and smile at every person I pass. And some people, you can't do it because they refuse to look at you. Other people, you know, you smile at somebody, what's likely to happen?
Yeah, they'll smile back.
They smile back, yeah. This is a natural thing. And they feel good, and you feel good.
Yeah.
They got a smile, you got a smile, they're liking to smile. The next person, go find somebody else to smile at because I want another smile. It's so easy, it costs nothing.
Absolutely.
But it's just part of the basic civility of treating people the way they deserve to be treated. And then finally, the S brings us full circle to silence, because the word silent is the same letters as the word listen, which was what we talked about in the beginning.
Yeah.
If I'm yammering and yammering and yammering, right, I'm hearing me. Well, I'm not going to learn anything, but listen to me. Because I'm not going to say anything I don't know already. But if I listen to you, you might have something to say that I haven't heard before. If it challenges me to reevaluate my thinking. You know, if I've got something wrong, I want to be corrected. I don't want somebody, I don't want to go around in my delusion and my error. I want to know I got it wrong so I can reevaluate. And you put it all together, and that's how you get an ethical culture.
I like it. I like it a lot. So, listeners, I hope you took notes and wrote that down, because it'll help you stay focused on being civil and ethical and empathetic in today's society. Can you describe some of the ethical dilemmas that you've witnessed or experienced?
Sure. One dilemma, this is something that's very small, but it's really one of my favorite stories because it's so small, because it's so simple. I go to a physical therapist, and one day she was complaining to me, she just doesn't know what to do, because she's been renting a room in a doctor's office for years, and every year they keep raising her rent, and it's gotten to the point where she just can't afford to stay there anymore. But she's become very good friends with these people, and they've been very good to her, and she's torn. She doesn't want to seem ungrateful, she doesn't want to damage the relationship, but she just doesn't feel she can afford to stay there, and she doesn't know how to handle it. So I said to her, listen, just tell them what you told me. Just say, I really want to stay with you, but I can't if the rent is this high. So I need you to lower the rent to this. If you do that, I can stay with you. If you don't do it, then I'm going to have to leave. What do you want to do? By shifting the question to them, with two equally acceptable and equally rational and reasonable choices, she doesn't have to worry about how her decision is going to be interpreted. She puts the ball in their court, she empowers them, and then they can make the choice that's right for them. What could have been either putting herself in a situation that was financially untenable or worrying about damaging a relationship, it all ended smoothly, amicably. They said, listen, we need to charge you more. She said, okay, then I'm going to go elsewhere. They parted friends. Interesting footnote. She's paying, thousands of dollars in rent since she moved. And they have yet to rent out her room.
Well, the price is too high.
Yeah.
Nobody can afford it.
Yeah. You know, that's a very small, simple, but it's, you know, if you take that principle of rather than trying to push people into the choices or the situation the way you want them, but rather reframe the issue and then defer to them, let them make the decision, then everything can work so much more smoothly.
Absolutely. Do you have another example of an ethical dilemma you've witnessed?
Well, yeah. This one is one that I really wasn't able to resolve. But it goes back to when my wife and I were teaching high school in Hungary. The culture in Hungary was very interesting. In many cases, ways the people were very refined, were very charming, but they also had a certain, a cultural orientation that we found difficult to deal with at times. And the school where we taught, I don't know if you want me to go into the details of how the disciplinary system worked, but it was, let's just say, wacky.
Okay.
And utterly ineffective.
Mm.
And we went to the administration and we said, listen, the students are out of control. There is absolute pandemonium. I mean, there were teachers leaving their classrooms in tears because the behavior was so terrible among the students. So the system you have, can you explain to us how it's supposed to work? And they gave us a very clear answer. They said, that's the way we do it in Hungary.
Wow.
We said, okay, but you can see that it's not working. Wouldn't it make sense to reevaluate it and try to find something that's going to work better? That's the way we do it in Hungary.
Huh.
We used every explanation we could find. And we always got the same answer. And so things persisted in that way through the entire year. Now, they knew it didn't work. They complained about the students just like we did. But they didn't have the will to make the effort to try to change it, to try to fix it.
Yeah.
The famous line from Stephen Covey, every organization is set up to get the results that it's getting.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So
it made me.
You don't like the results.
Yeah.
You're back to Einstein's definition of insanity. Keep doing the same thing and hope you get different results. It never happens.
As you describe the behavior of the students and the rules and guidelines there in Hungary, it made me think of the old movie To Sir with Love, because Sidney Poitier, that's what he inherited, a bunch of misfits who treated the teachers poorly and all that kind of stuff. And it turns out all they needed was someone to care about them, to have empathy for them, and to show them that the possibilities that are out there, and it turned them around. So I mentioned that because it's been going on for a long time, and not just in Hungary either.
There've been some true stories like that, like teachers that wrote books about how they turned around these classes. But there are only a handful of those stories. There are a lot more stories that are like mine, where it just wasn't the will to make the changes that were necessary.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I think again with students and some of the ethical dilemmas that I have witnessed, I'm a professional speaker. I give seminars for corporate clients, and I've had people in my seminars that cannot read. And I'm thinking, this is all adults who are working in corporate America. And how did the school graduate you? And you go to college and graduate and not be able to read. To me, that's an ethical dilemma right there, because a school should never allow something like that to happen. But those people are in the workplace today, and there are a lot of them that don't know how to read. I had one lady tell me very proudly, she had three children, she said, and she goes, I haven't read a textbook since high school. I don't ever want to read a textbook again. And I said, don't you read to your children? And she said, no, I hate reading. And I actually felt sorry for her children, who I've never met, because she's just an attendee at a seminar. But if you're in an environment like that, the ethics flows right out of the home into the school and back around in that circle you were talking about a minute ago. One would think
absolutely.
It's impossible to graduate from school and not know how to read. But they're out there.
Well, I'll tell you, as a career teacher, it's a tough job.
I know.
The pay is inadequate.
I know.
There's often very little support.
I know.
And the biggest problem often is the parents.
Really?
Teachers are often under siege from parents.
Yeah.
My principal came into the office one day and he was so agitated. He said, I just can't believe believe this. And nothing like this has ever happened before. And I thought, I've been teaching for almost 20 years. what hasn't happened before? What could be so bad? And he said, a mother made an appointment with me. And she said, does the math teacher have to grade in red ink?
Oh, please.
And the truth is, there's a big trend to use purple now.
Oh,
the
my.
Teacher's going to solve anything.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, a purple F is much more easier to deal with than a red F.
That's hilarious and a wonderful point to get to the end of our discussion. So I'm wondering, do you have any final comments for our listeners around ethics and ethical affluence or whatever you decide?
I would say be courageous. It can be hard to do the right thing. It can be painful. It can be scary. It can be, sometimes you really have to sacrifice to do the right thing. But the more individuals who make it their commitment to do what's right, to stand up for what's right, to speak out for what's right, the more that will influence the culture. When you see somebody acting heroically, you want to be a hero. So if you don't see anybody acting heroically, you be the hero.
You be the hero.
And let somebody be inspired by you.
That's wonderful. Thank you very much for being our guest on the show.
It was very much my pleasure.
And I would like to share with everyone that your website, if they want to learn more about you, they can visit your website at www.yonasongolson.com. That's www.yonasongolson.com. And I highly recommend, if they're interested in ethics, that they get you a copy of your book titled Fix Your Broken Windows, A 12-Step System for Promoting Ethical Affluence. Thank you very, very much, Yonasson, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you, Yvonne. All the best.
Thanks to all of you for joining us today for the Find Yourself, Live Your Dreams, and Be Happy show. Join us again next month on the second Saturday at 2 p.m. Central Time. Until then, let me leave you with these final words. Zadie Smith said, "It seems that if you put people on paper and move them through time, you cannot help but talk about ethics, because the ethical realm exists nowhere, if not here, in the consequences of human actions as they unfold in time and the multiple interpretive possibility of those actions." Remember to find yourself, live your dreams, and be happy. And also follow the show at blogtalkradio.com/Yvonne-Heff-Brown. Then leave your comments about today's show. If you have a topic you would like us to cover, just leave us a comment right here at blogtalkradio.com. Thank you for listening.